Friends, hear what the Spirit is saying to the church today from Deuteronomy 30. Surely this commandment that I am commanding you today is not too hard for you, nor is it too far away. It is not in heaven that you should say, "Who will go up to heaven for us and get it so that we may hear it and observe it?" Neither is it beyond the sea that you should say, "Who will cross to the other side of the sea for us and get it for us so that we may hear it and observe it?" No, the word is very near to you. It is in your mouth and in your heart for you to observe. See, I have set before you today life and prosperity, death and adversity. If you obey the commandments of the Lord your God that I am commanding you today by loving the Lord your God, walking in his way, and observing his commandments, decrees, and ordinances, then you shall live and become numerous, and the Lord your God will bless you in the land that you are entering to possess. But if your heart turns away and you do not hear, but are led astray to bow down to the other gods and serve them, I declare to you today that you shall perish. You shall not live long in the land that you are crossing the Jordan to enter and possess. I call heaven and earth to witness against you today that I have set before you life and death, blessings and curses. Choose life so that you and your descendants may live, loving the Lord your God, obeying him, and holding fast to him. For that means life to you and length of days, so that you may live in the land that the Lord swore to give to your ancestors, Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. The next reading is from Matthew, and it is a little bit hardcore, and Emily has asked that I ask you not to leave the service before she has an opportunity to speak about it. So here we go, from Matthew 5. You have heard that it was said to those of ancient time, "You shall not murder, and whoever murders shall be liable to judgment. But I say to you that if you are angry with a brother or sister, you will be liable to judgment. And if you insult a brother or sister, you will be liable to the council. And if you say, 'You fool,' you will be liable to the hell of fire. So when you are offering your gift at the altar, if you remember that your brother or sister has something against you, leave your gift there before the altar and go. First be reconciled to your brother or sister, and then come and offer your gift. Come to terms quickly with your accuser while you're on your way to court with him, or your accuser may hand you over to the judge, and the judge to the guard, and you will be thrown into prison. Truly, I tell you, you will never get out until you have paid the last penny. You have heard that it was said, 'You shall not commit adultery.' But I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lust has already committed adultery with her in his heart. If your right eye causes you to sin, tear it out and throw it away. It is better that for you to lose one of your members than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. It is better for you to lose one of your members than for your whole body to go to hell. It was also said, 'Whoever divorces his wife, let him give her a certificate of divorce.' But I say to you that anyone who divorces his wife, except on the ground of unchastity, causes her to commit adultery, and whoever marries a divorced woman commits adultery. Again, you have heard that it was said of those of ancient times, 'You shall not swear falsely, but carry out the vows you have made to the Lord.' But I say to you, do not swear at all, either by heaven, for it is the throne of God, or by earth, for it is his footstool, or by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. And do not swear by your head, For you cannot make one hair white or black. Let your word be yes, yes, or no, no. Anything more than this comes from the evil one. This is the story of life for the people of God.
Thanks be to God.
Okay. So before I preach, and before I even pray, we have to address a couple things because I can't bear the thought of you sitting there afraid or shamed or any such thing. Do you remember where we are in the text? Pop quiz, those of you who have been here the last couple weeks, what are we doing? Sermon on the Mount, Jesus' first public act of ministry in the gospel according to Matthew. The first part of it was the Beatitudes, and it started with the word blessed. And we said that the first word, the first thing is the most important, right? Blessed is the most important takeaway. Blessed is the most important takeaway. So exhale. If you just heard that scary stuff about pulling out your eyes and going to hell, exhale. Blessed is the most important takeaway. Here's why. This text and all 66 books of the Bible were written in a different time, in a different historical context. The author of Matthew believed that Jesus was coming back any day, any minute. It never occurred to him that we'd be reading these words 2,000 years later. And likewise, Jesus gathered his people. He was preaching a sermon to disciples, telling a specific people in a specific time how to be disciples of Jesus there in their place and time. He was not setting exact and specific rules for how all people who ever lived should follow line by line. You get it? He was speaking to people in a time and a place. And in this case, he was offering a corrective for an unjust law. And the law was this: a man could divorce his wife at any moment for any reason. If she burned his dinner, if he found someone more beautiful. You think I'm joking, but these are real things that happened. He could give her a certificate. And women did not have access to the economy in the way that we have access to the economy now. So if a man divorced his wife for any reason, she and her children were poor, had nothing, had no guarantee of well-being, had no way to make money. And if a woman did remarry, it was not a given that the husband would take in the children she had from the first marriage. I really wish that Jesus would come and guest preach once in a while, so that we could ask him. We could say, Jesus, 2,000 years later, everything's different. Women have access to the economy now. Does it still stand? What does it mean for us now? But Jesus hasn't done that yet. And it would be great if he did, but I don't think we can bank on it. So we have to use our hearts and our minds and our understanding of who Jesus was and what he was trying to do to interpret what those words might mean for us today. That is an ongoing project that every Christian has to undertake. I say all of this because I believe with my whole being that Jesus, who came that we might have life and might have life abundantly, was not making a law for us to stay in unhealthy and unhappy and sometimes even dangerous marriages, when divorce might mean finding wholeness and health and thriving. And I know there are people in this room who are divorced, who are remarried, who have friends and family and loved ones who are divorced and remarried, and I had to speak to that specific part before I could even preach because I'm afraid that you're going to feel pain and shame. Do you hear me? Do you hear what I'm saying, that we have to read this? Jesus said it, and he said it in a context. And what we do with that is up to each of us to interpret. What does that mean for us today? I think making choices for wholeness and health and well-being are not against God's will for us. Everybody okay? Okay. I feel committed to preaching the hard texts, and I feel afraid of preaching the hard texts because they're scary. Sometimes the Bible is scary. Can I preach now? Would you pray with me? Holy and loving God, help us to hear your voice in these old and ancient words. Help us to hear your call to us and shield us from interpretations that would do harm and damage to our hearts. Teach us to hear your voice through the noise of the world. Teach us to hear your love and your light shining through. Amen. So I'm going to talk about snow again. One of my favorite things, one of my many favorite things about snowstorms is the way they bring us together and remind us that we cannot do this life alone. I was up in Portland on Thursday working on this sermon and helping a friend with her new baby, and I got snowed in there. And I went for a snowy walk in the city just because I could. And on that snowy walk, I saw people digging each other out of snowbanks. And I saw people helping each other get cars that had gone off the road back onto the road again. I saw people clutching mittened hands. Those Portland bricks are so slippery when it gets snowy. I saw people clutching mittened hands trying to make it over the slippery parts. I slipped myself, and a man I didn't know offered me a hand up, and later down the road, a man I didn't know slipped, and I offered him a hand up, and would you believe it, by the time I got back to my car, somebody had cleaned my car off for me. I know, it was amazing. There were people all over the city clutching to each other in the daily work of running errands and enjoying the snow and just being out. In our world where we so often pretend like we're okay on our own, where we close our doors and we pull our blinds and we pretend like we don't desperately, desperately need one another, it is so heartening to me to walk around in a snowstorm and to watch us all realize again and again that we need each other's mittened hands to pick each other up when we've fallen, to help somebody else along the way who slipped in front of us. That is actually what our passage is about today. It's not about snowstorms, but it is about our interconnectedness and our interdependence. And it's beautifully and it's terrifyingly hyperbolic. You know that word hyperbole? It's way, way bigger than Jesus, than somebody explain hyperbole for me. It's it's exaggeration in a really big way. If your eye is causing you to sin, pluck it out. Jesus doesn't actually mean that you should pluck out your eye. And if something terrible is happening, you might get cast into hell. Someday I'll preach a sermon about hell. The actual word is Gehenna. It's a trash dump outside the city limits. He's just saying, if you don't do this, the consequences are really, really bad. Jesus is speaking in extremes to drive his point home here. He's saying the rules of this life and the expectations and the laws that our leaders make of us are important. And also we are held to bigger laws, to God's laws. So to paraphrase the scripture, that first paragraph is saying it's not enough to follow the law and refrain from murder. We must, to use those words from Deuteronomy, we must choose life. And we must treat each other with respect, and so that means not using hateful words. And that second paragraph, it's not enough to just avoid committing the actual act of adultery. We should choose life, and so not objectify one another and use each other to satisfy our lust. That third paragraph, it's not enough to follow the letter of the law regarding divorce. We should choose life and so not treat each other as disposable, and so make sure that the most vulnerable, in this case, women and children, are provided for. And And that last paragraph, it's not enough to keep ourselves from swearing falsely or lying to others. We should choose life, and so speak and act truthfully in all of our dealings so that we don't need to make oaths at all. He's saying the law is here, but I'm saying something so much bigger than the law. Follow the law, but choose life. Be kind, do better. That is what discipleship means. Homiletics professor and John scholar Caroline Lewis wrote it this way. In other words, Jesus is saying that interpreting the law is far more complex than you make it out to be. And if your interpretations lead to death, the silence of voices, the discounting of the personhood of the other, the disrespect and demeaning of entire groups of people, the labeling, thereby putting people in their place, then you have to think long and hard about what it means to be a disciple of Jesus. That's what this is all about. The Sermon on the Mount is teaching us how to be disciples of Jesus. We interpret the law, yes, and also something so much bigger is being asked of us. And this was written 2,000 years ago, and I say we have to take it in context, and also, friends, now I think would be a good time for so many of us to think about what it means to be disciples of Jesus. It's crazy out there. We're in a country so divided, we can't agree on anything. It is exhausting, isn't it, to just be part of that chaos. We are held to Jesus, to God's law, to something bigger than the chaos out there. We had 50-something people here on Friday night to have a hard and holy conversation as so many people lifted up in our gratitude moment. And the takeaway was that we have a lot of work to do. We have a lot of work to do to build the world, to build the kind of communities that we want to be living in. One courageous and kind woman of color at the event said so bravely, "It is exhausting to spend one's life constantly vigilant because of the ways we are always reminding each other, I am not like you, and you are not like me." We need disciples. We need people who can rise above all of this and recognize that we are called to something bigger than battling and fighting with one another all the time. We need people who can choose life. And so it is so heartening to me that beginning, that opening for Deuteronomy, our Deuteronomy lectionary passage today, that the author says, "Surely this commandment that I'm commanding you today is not too hard for you. Surely this is easy, what I'm saying. And it's not far off. It's not meant for heaven. It's not meant for later." The author says this is actually an easy thing to do. Surely I'm telling you choosing life is something you can do now in this moment and in the next moment. It's for now in your life. I'm getting lost because I really like that. And I get distracted by it because it's not so easy, but I love that the author tells us it's so easy. It's not a lofty idea for later. It's possible now to choose life for ourselves and for one another, to honor God by honoring one another, to reveal something about who we believe God is by how we treat God's children in our midst. As I close today, I want to share with you a new favorite poem of mine that I just stumbled upon. It's by Marilyn Maciel, and it's called Clothesline. Do any of you know this poem? It's beautiful. We need it right now. She writes, "I, you, us, them, those people, wouldn't it be lovely if one could live in a constant state of we. Some of the most commonplace words can be some of the biggest dividers. They. What if there was no they? What if there was only us? If words could be seen as they floated out of our mouths, would we feel no shame as they passed beyond our lips? If we were to string our words on a communal clothesline, would we feel proud as our thoughts flapped in the breeze? What an image that is. If we could string our words, our thoughts on a communal clothesline, would we feel proud as they flapped in the breeze? And I would add, would that honor God? Would we honor the God we believe in if our words, our thoughts, our intentions were hung together on a communal clothesline, flapping in the breeze? So this week, beloved of God, I invite you to be the people our world so dearly needs right now. And that is people who are disciples of Jesus, who are understanding that we can rise above and meet one another in God's call for us, which is so much bigger than anything we people are squabbling about here on earth. And could we remember that we are way less alone and way more in need of one another than we pretend to be? Could we let the snow this weekend bring that out? Could we be a people who are brave enough to choose life together? Brave enough to reveal our belief in God by the way we tend to the children of God among us, by the way we string our words on that communal clothesline, by the way we offer one mittened hand after another to those on the journey with us, scooping each other up off the ice as we fall. Alleluia.